In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, listeners, I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. So we welcome your phone calls this afternoon. If you'd like to talk with Susan, give us a call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness, and she's the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. You'll find Susan on the web at www.eatandmove.com. And questions about diet, nutrition, and exercise? They're invited this afternoon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Well, each month we like to have a topic we can talk about during any lull in the phone calls, but we've already got a phone call.
Okay.
We've already got a listener dialing in this afternoon, ready to go on the toll-free line. A listener in Homewood on line four. Hi.
Yeah, hi. The question was, I've heard that the head lettuce food value is like zero. Is that right?
Well, it really seems to be related to the color of the lettuce. So, for example, if you have just an iceberg lettuce, there may not be a lot of nutrients in that. There certainly are some, and there's some fiber, and there's some fluid, but it doesn't have a lot of other nutrients. I think one thing that certainly just lettuce like that does have, if you like it, is the fact that you can eat a lot of it and it's so low in calories. And so as a base, you could certainly have a big salad, if you like, iceberg lettuce, and then throw on some red peppers or tomatoes or some other things maybe to boost the nutritional quality. And what you're eating is a lot of food without a lot of calories. And so there's a definite benefit to it. But we do know that if you look at nutritional quality, if you can go to a little bit of a red lettuce or green leaf lettuce, and certainly if you can go to a spinach, something like that, then there's probably a lot more other nutrients, vitamin A, vitamin C, and a lot of those, beta carotene. So the darker is better if you like it, but if you don't like it, you still get some benefit out of the light lettuces, just not as much.
Okay, then a further fine point, like on romaine lettuce, where you have a very large leaf with a very large stalk in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
That center part, the stalk, is there anything in that?
Well, certainly
besides
there's
fiber.
Right, mainly fiber, I would say. Certainly there's going to be some nutrients in that, too. I don't know how that breaks down in terms of, we know the darker, again, is better, so we would expect farther out on the leaf it would be more vitamin A, more beta carotene, and some of these other phytonutrients. But I wouldn't say not to eat that part that's low because, again, it's got a lot of fluid and it's got fiber for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and say like on broccoli, I've always heard that the flowered part is more valuable food-wise or nutrition-wise than the stalk. Is that an urban myth?
Well, I think that's probably where a lot of the nutrients are, certainly is in the little flowerets that we tend to eat typically. But, one thing, if you looked at the stalk, and again, I don't know the exact breakdown, but I would expect there isn't going to be as much of certain nutrients in that. But, you know, just as a rule of thumb, a good thing to do is to just cut off the outside real woody parts of that stalk and then just chop up the middle and use that. I just steamed some last night and that's how we did it. And you get, certainly there's going to be a lot of nutritional quality even in that stalk. The main reason people throw that out is because it's so woody. But if you cut off, you know, slice around the outside and cut that stuff off, then you can steam that along with it and you get some more nutrients in there, lots of fiber, and maybe, again, not as much as the flowerettes, but still very nutritious.
Okay, same question in regard to pickles and radishes.
Well, pickles and radishes, I think, you know, again, have some nutritional value. We don't necessarily consider those maybe as the highest, although radishes certainly have certain phytochemicals. The biggest concern with pickles is if you eat a good amount of those, you're getting so much sodium. That would be the, you know, the main concern with that. But
right.
In terms of the amount that you would have to eat, if you compared, let's say, to a fresh cucumber, where you're going to get, again, probably more fiber, you're not going to have all that salt, all that sodium. So pickles used as a condiment are fine. You wouldn't probably want to eat a lot of those anyhow.
Right. Where would you find out the basics? I mean, where can you go look up this kind of information?
Mm-hmm. Probably the best place is the USDA website.
Okay.
And you could even, you could even search on the web USDA plus nutrition. And there are a lot of different sites within the USDA website, but if you just went to USDA.gov, I believe is what it is, then go under nutrition, and then there are listings. The USDA has listings for every food. You can, and in there you can put in the food and you can ask for example, which foods are highest in vitamin C per cup or per 100 gram measure, which foods are high in other nutrients. So it's a great resource, and that's where we get a lot of our, you know, if you look in a book and it has the nutritional value of certain foods, it's generally based on these USDA tables.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're very welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've got a question regarding changing your diet. If my father-in-law had surgery on his knee, and I was wondering if, would you recommend that people slightly increase their protein intake to recover? Obviously, it would only be for muscle tissue. That would help, but do you recommend that people increase their protein intake to recover from surgery or something like that?
Well, I think that, and I deal a lot with this because I deal so much with athletes who may be undergoing certain surgery or work with people after surgery, and I think protein is something you do want to look really closely at. Now, depending upon how someone's eating to begin with, they may not need to increase it, but we want to make sure it's adequate. If we look at protein intake and kind of depends on how active he's able to be and those kinds of things. But certainly I try to make sure that at the very least someone has 0.5 grams per pound, 0.5 grams of protein per pound of body weight that they're taking in after surgery. That's one thing we look at pretty closely. We also look at vitamin C. For a lot of clients I work with, we may supplement with 500 milligrams of vitamin C twice a day, only because that's not a level that's going to be too high by any means. But we know that if we can keep vitamin C levels up in the blood, that may help with healing. And so try to eat foods high in vitamin C, as well as perhaps looking at that supplementation as well. And then other things that certainly have gotten a lot of, you know, interest lately, and something that I look at sometimes individually with clients, particularly if they're having trouble with a lot of inflammation after surgery, is we look at omega-3 fatty acid supplements. And that might be something that is worth looking at with, talking to a surgeon about too, because with recovery, we know if the body can decrease inflammation after surgery, there's certainly a lot better chance of faster recovery. And so with many of my athletes, we do generally supplement with 1 to 3 grams of omega-3 fatty acids, because, you know, studies are pretty clear that in a lot of people that decreases inflammation. And so I would say we look at C very closely, protein, and essential fatty acids, as well as staying hydrated, because often we don't stay as hydrated after surgery. We're not as active. We're not as thirsty. But if your body's hydrated, we know that may help with healing as well. And so just eating well, eating on a schedule, then we look at some of those key nutrients that we mentioned.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is our guest this afternoon here on the program. Your questions about diet, nutrition, exercise, all invited this afternoon. Well, We have a little lull.
Okay.
Okay. So you suggested we talk about how our eyes are affected by nutrition. And I suspect most of us were told as children to eat our carrots.
That's right.
Because carrots are good for our eyes. What's in carrots that have led adults to say that to kids now for a couple of generations at least?
Right. Well, carrots are really high in beta carotene. Beta carotene is, we think of beta carotene kind of like vitamin A. It's more of a natural source of that. And we know that nutrients like beta carotene, nutrients like phytochemicals, lutein and zeaxanthin, which they may start sounding familiar because we've heard more about them, particularly some supplements or multivitamins now that have lutein. They say lutein added, zeaxanthin added. These are antioxidants or phytochemicals that are found primarily in fruits and vegetables, primarily dark green, leafy green, orange, yellow. And some of these nutrients, some of these particular antioxidants, as well as, let's say, vitamin A, vitamin C, zinc, some other things that have been studied pretty closely for eye health, may actually be concentrated in the eye, or particularly in the macula. We hear a lot lately about macular degeneration mm-hmm. and how that's becoming more and more common. And even this morning, I had a client I'd worked with quite a while ago called and asked about specifics for macular degeneration because she's just been diagnosed with that and what should she be eating and had heard about different nutrients and that kind of thing. So I think it brings up a couple issues. I think one thing that it comes back to is this whole idea that we've talked about so many times that eating more produce is so helpful and particularly getting a wide variety so that you're getting a lot of different colors. We know that those are all beneficial. There have been a few studies that have come out recently. There was one a few years ago that was an eye health study that looked at supplementing with vitamin A, vitamin C, zinc, and some of these other nutrients and found a decreased risk of macular degeneration, particularly in people with whom it had already begun. And so not necessarily prevention, but for those that mm-hmm. already had a problem with it, that it decreased how fast it went forward. But some recent studies have looked just at diet. In other words, those people with much higher intake of fruits and vegetables are seeing much lower rates of macular degeneration. And so, you know, a lot of things that we can take out from that are saying, okay, more produce we know is helpful. There's no question about it. And if we look at some of these key nutrients, and particularly, like I mentioned, the beta carotene and vitamin A, vitamin C, zinc, vitamin E also, mm-hmm. and this lutein and zeaxanthin, it's a matter of kind of focusing on these foods. I think I'm just a big believer that making lists, having things around, getting more foods at the grocery store, we tend to eat them more. And so I've kind of come up with a list of the top 10, if we have time for that now.
Sure.
People always ask me, you know, what might be your top 5 or top 10? And so not that these foods are miracle foods by any means, but I think if you wanted to eat more foods to help your eyes, we know some of them would be spinach,
mm-hmm.
broccoli, any kind of greens, leafy greens of any kind. Corn, and that's great to hear around here. Peppers, green and red peppers, yellow peppers, orange peppers. Sweet potatoes, which of course you just look at those and you know they're healthy. Cantaloupe, which that mm-hmm. color is great. Any kind of nuts, because they tend to be pretty high in vitamin E, particularly peanuts, almonds, walnuts, those type of nuts. Red grapefruit, which is, you look at those real bright red mm-hmm. grapefruit, and that's real high in phytochemicals. And of course, carrots.
Okay.
Because those are pretty good. The other night I had a dinner out and the vegetable of the day was carrots. So they had carrots and then I had a sweet potato as a side and I sat there thinking, this is so wonderful for eyes. And I don't know if everybody thought that, but it was kind of a silly thought. I just sat there and thought, just all this orange was so great.
Yeah.
And we don't typically eat like, I mean, generally we may not have all that color at a meal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So looking at color.
Well, we're just talking about eyes. Well, you know, when the plate comes to you, whether, you know, you're out at dinner or whether you're at home composing that plate to take to the table, it's so important that it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's important to all of us. You know, it's got to look good. So if it's loaded with color, that's going to be, it's going to be pretty
right.
as well as obviously healthy
exactly.
for us.
Exactly.
We've got a listener in Indiana waiting to talk with us now. Line 4. Good afternoon.
I can give the information. At least there's a couple things I wanted to ask about. But the first thing is the more important. I'm looking for something. I know on some of the nutrition facts on packaging, they'll talk about this assumes a 2,000 calorie a day diet, you know, then they'll give you how much percentage of the ingredients they have does that. And right now I'm on a diabetic diet. I know that I get approximately 195 grams of carbs. What I'm wanting to do is to find a place that might have, along with 195 carbs, how many grams of protein am I supposed to have? How many of this, how much of that, and how much of that am I supposed to have? I was hoping there's a site that would give that information or something close to it where, you know, I can at least put it together. I like to exchange my foods around quite a bit, and so I'm in the place where I keep track of what's what in the main nutrition figures. And I'm wanting to change my calorie intake and go down or go up or whatever, but I'd like to know if there's a place that can give me that information, that, you know, what I'm supposed to shoot for. Then I can, you know, 1 week do one group of foods, another week do another group of foods. Things I really like, I can't eat anymore, so I tire quickly of the taste of certain foods since I've been on this diet. But I want to be religious about the diet. I don't want to go through the hassle I've already gone through with a stroke. Thanks.
Okay, good question.
Yeah, well, I would say, and maybe you've already done this, but I would certainly work to develop an individual plan with a dietitian, because when you're looking closely at any at the diabetic diet per se or any medical concern, I think it's really important, like you're saying, you need to know how much protein you require for your body, because it's different for everyone depending upon their body weight and activity and those kinds of things. So your needs could be figured out very specifically working with somebody. And I think, you know, looking at, let's say, for example, you're saying you're on about 195 grams of carbohydrate, that's going to be roughly 800 calories of carbohydrate. And so generally that for most people is around 50 to 60% of what they eat. So, you know, looking at what you're taking in there, if you compared protein and fat to that, that may be around 20% of each of your diet. So you could sort of figure that out based upon calories, but it would be very specific for your needs. And that's where I think, like you're saying, you know, one of the most beneficial things working individually with a registered dietitian is to be able to kind of develop some of these sample meal plans and figure out what that looks like on a label for you and everything. And as you mentioned, the 2,000 calorie diet, that's just very broad. You're obviously going to be eating a little bit less than that if 800 calories are carbohydrate right now, probably. So when you look at that, you probably need to know, well, how does that relate to me if I'm on 1,700 or 1,800 or something like that? You know, we know our general protein needs for the population are about 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And so, you know, if you took your weight in pounds, divided it by 2.2 times 0.8, that's kind of our general recommendation. But that's not very specific when it comes to working individually with somebody, because, like I mentioned, there are different needs. So, but you could use that kind of as a general guide, or a very simplified version of that is take your weight, divide it in half. So if you're 180 pounds, that might be 90 grams of protein if you're moderately active. And so what we're finding, you know, as far as protein, and like you're saying with the diabetic diet in particular, is that, you know, carbohydrate grams are important. Getting enough fiber is important. Protein at each meal is important. Having the right kind of fat in your diet, more monounsaturated fat, is important. So there are a lot of things that you could sort of work in there that could be really helpful if you had a specific plan working with someone.
Okay. And also on the web, he mentioned web resources. Can you point him in a direction? Are there calculators out there for...
Yeah, there certainly are calculators out there. There's, you know, I think a good place for everyone to start if they're saying, well, I'm trying to figure out based upon here's my body, this is my activity, this is what I'm trying to do, lose weight or gain weight, and how much should I eat? The new pyramid, the My Pyramid, we call it, just at mypyramid.gov, is a good, really good place to start, because you can plug all that stuff in there and you can plug your activity in and your goals, and it will give you the recommended servings from the different serving groups to meet your goals. And so that's a very good place to start, because it doesn't necessarily give grams of every single thing. It gives recommended serving amounts, which is basically what we need in terms of how we're eating. So that's probably a really good place to start. And there are other websites Certainly, there's a website called eDiets. I think it's .com, and they have calculators and different things on there too. Even the prevention website has a lot of good calculators and figures on there, just prevention.com. And so those might be some good places to look as well to get, you know, to kind of do some more individualized. I think, you know, I don't think everybody in the whole world has to meet with a registered dietitian, but I think when you have a specific health concern you're looking at and you're kind of tailoring what we would call a therapeutic diet, the diet that's really going to help you manage or prevent disease, it's really, that's the time you think, gosh, this is going to be a big help because, you know, I really need something more specific to me than probably what's out there for the general population.
Okay. And for finding a dietitian in your particular neck of the woods, how do you find somebody who's, you know, a registered dietitian, maybe is a member of a professional organization?
Mm-hmm.
What is it, the American Dietetic Association?
Right. The American Dietetic Association, you can find dietitians, particularly if you're online, that's easy. It's just www.eatright, eatright.org. And that's the best place to look as a beginning because you can actually put in, okay, I live here, and if
your
can you find
code or your
a dietitian within 30 miles of me who might specialize in these areas, and so that's a big help. And if someone even wants to email me, I get a lot of emails saying, gosh, I live here, do you know of anybody here or people specializing?
Sure.
Then I'm happy to help too, because it's really helpful to find somebody in your area to help with that too. And I think even now there are a lot of online programs and things that you can work with somebody even online if you wanted to and not necessarily have to be there. So.
Oh, that's great. Okay, let's talk with another listener. A caller on a cell phone on line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm on the road quite a bit, and I try to eat correctly. And I'll give a plug to Ruby Tuesday Salad Bar.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best in the world, but a lot of times I have to just stop somewhere at a fast food place, and I get tired of the dry grilled chicken sandwiches. Do you have any specifics that you can help me out with that I can eat something and not be really horrible for me?
Well, I think there are a lot of good choices. I think even a place, let's say, place that has sub sandwiches, which a lot of places do now as something different, because you can, the thing about a sub sandwich is you can get vegetables on there, which is great. You can get, you know, some salad dressing on there that might be low fat, so it's not as high in fat for you. You can get some lean turkey or lean ham or lean roast beef or something on there. And so that's always a good option if you got somewhere where you could get the sub type of thing. And I think if you're looking at something red meat oriented for fast food, then even something like a roast beef sandwich. I mean, a regular roast beef sandwich is not very high in fat. Again, the thing you want to watch is the sauces or things. So I would get things as plain as possible, or you put on a little bit of sauce or barbecue sauce or something, or even regular hamburgers. I mean, if you get two regular hamburgers and you get a low-fat shake or something like that, it's really not too bad because it's something a little bit different than grilled chicken, like you're saying, but it's not fried. And so the thing that you really want to watch, I think, when you're on the road, that you're not going to biggie everything, because once you biggie everything, then you're in big-time trouble. Or even one of my rules of thumb is just to say, well, get two sandwiches as opposed to sandwich and fries, because then you just don't have all this grease that you really just don't need. I mean, or if you get fries.
I've been off the fries for a while, so.
Yeah, that's a big help. I mean, I think other things are even things like taco places. So let's say you get three soft-shell tacos, or you get a bean burrito and a couple soft-shell tacos. That's actually a pretty good choice because you're getting fiber. It's not fried. You know, you're getting pretty good choice in something like that. And also places that maybe you could get soups, or if you have time, or places where you could get baked potatoes, which several places have that now. And so even something like chili and baked potato and a side salad at Wendy's is actually really inexpensive, and it gives you a really good balance and tons of fiber, and so that might be an option. I think sometimes what we think about when we're on the road, too, is that we don't have time to stop, but I always encourage people, even if you stop for 20 minutes and you actually sit down and eat something, then you could eat a salad with something.
Mm-hmm.
You could eat soup, and so that broadens your nutritional opportunities rather than always eating in the car, so that's something that can help, too.
Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate the tip.
Sure. You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. What could this guy carry in the car that, you know, the weather is nice now, so you might be able to stop and stop at a park or, you know, get out and have a little walk and sit at a picnic table and that kind of thing. What could he have in the car that he could pull out that, you know, you can leave in a hot car or whatever,
right.
But, you know, it's good to go.
Mm-hmm. I think things like individualized portions of, let's say, trail mix. Because let's say you have sunflower seeds and you have dried fruit, and some that's actually, you mix that with some whole grain cereal and throw those in Ziploc bags. Those keep well, and that's a really good snack. It's basically kind of like if you'd stop and get maybe a sugary granola bar, but it doesn't have all the sugar. Yeah, it's basically just the food. And so something like that is great. I mean, even things, you know, I guess if it's really hot, something like an apple wouldn't keep that well. But generally, apples, oranges, that kind of stuff, those are really easy, and those can keep really well too with just some quick fruit. I think if you're traveling just for the day, then I think it's always helpful just to pack a little cooler where you could throw in baby carrots, fruit, grapes, something like that, that maybe again you're stopping, you're getting a couple sandwiches, but then you're throwing in your add-ons that might be fruit and, you know, those small bags of baby carrots are great because we'll just chomp on those like we would French fries, and before you know it, that's gone and you've got all these nutrients in and helping your eyes. So, you know, you've got a lot of things, and I really like grapes because they're just so easy and fast, and then dried fruit is always a good option too. And I even think, you know, the 100% juices that are the small 8-ounce single serving size that are 100%, those are great too because maybe you go through fast food and you get water and then you have 100% juice that's not too many calories because it's just 8 ounces. It's not a huge one. And then that allows you to get a fruit serving in, and very simple, very easy. And so being prepared, I think, is really helpful if you're on the road. I know if you're traveling 5 or 6 days at a time, it may not be as feasible. But the other thing to always remember is that you can stop at a grocery store when you're traveling, too. And so often if I'm on the road, we might stop at a deli at a grocery store. And so you're getting fruit, you're getting some other stuff.
Yeah, now you can stop at a grocery store, and the lots of them have, you know, like you can get a small There's calories in this, I know, but, you know, get one roll and get, you know, a couple of slices of your favorite lean meat at the deli.
Mm-hmm.
And often at the deli now, they will have small packets of mustard or barbecue sauce, that kind of thing. So you can fix yourself a sandwich.
Right. You can do that. And like you mentioned, I think places like Ruby Tuesdays or places where you can go and just really get high-quality salad bar when you have time is great. Because you can cover a lot there. And so maybe your next meal isn't as healthy, but you had all these vegetables and fruits in one meal. And so that makes it not really so bad if you're going to go through fast food and not have the best meal, your next choice.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line 2. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Could you tell me how safe Splendor is? I'll hang up and listen to you.
Okay.
The sugar substitute Splendor?
Mm-hmm.
I heard my sister called me and told me that she saw on the news where it was causing people problems, and I told her I had never heard it. But I would like to know, do you think it's pretty safe, and is it safe enough to use every day? Mm-hmm. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, I think with artificial sweeteners like Splenda, certainly they've been through all kinds of testing, not to say we're not going to find out new things about them, but used in moderation. And I guess I would say in moderation, let's say in a day, if you would have 2 or 3 things that are sweetened with Splenda, maybe you have a diet soda that has Splenda in it, maybe you have a yogurt that has Splenda in it, and maybe you put a little bit in a cup of coffee. Personally, that wouldn't concern me at all at that amount. If you're using it in everything and you're baking with it and your every meal you have 2 or 3 servings of Splenda, then you may need to just think about, are you having too many sweetened things in general and not enough whole foods? And so that might be a concern if you're using it so much. But I'd say 2 or 3 servings, that's kind of my rule of thumb, 2 or 3 servings a day, generally from what we know in terms of the amounts that could potentially be harmful, I wouldn't worry about that. And then I would try to also get a lot of fruits in and whole foods and natural sources of sugar as well. And so occasionally I will have clients who have 2 or 3 2-liter diet sodas a day, and that's a lot of sweetener, and that's a lot of acid and other things. So then you just have to kind of assess, is what's the quality of my diet when I'm using all these sugar-free type things. I think they can be very helpful, particularly if you're diabetic or particularly if you're really monitoring calories. And I don't personally think that there's going to be a problem at these lower levels. we usually see more problems or intolerances if people use huge amounts of any of these types of sweeteners, in which case I'd be a little bit more concerned. And there are certainly cases of certain people not being able to digest them very well or having problems with them. And so if you're one of those people, I'd say avoid them. But it's kind of like some other things that we see in food or flavorings or things that some people just really have a problem with. But I wouldn't worry if you use a few servings a day, and that's typically what you do every day. To me, that wouldn't be a concern.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. A listener in Bloomington on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about fats. They seem to be ever-changing and confusing to me. We talk about saturated fats and unsaturated fats, and I know it has to do with the chemistry of carbon atoms and that kind of thing. And I know that the saturated fats are the ones that we're trying to avoid. But I see polyunsaturates and monounsaturates, and I'm wondering if those are all, acceptable, quote, good oils.
Yeah.
And the other thing, recently I was looking at, I know that they suggest some vegetable or fruit oils are also not good for you, meaning the tropical. And I saw one that said palm fruit oil. And I wondered if that was a new way of saying coconut.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of good questions. I think it does get very confusing with fats and what to take in and how much of everything. I think if you look at the big picture of fats, there are a couple things you want to try to do. One is to avoid most things that are fried, because we know that those fats tend to be more saturated, or they tend to be more fats that maybe have started out liquid and become more hardened. And just those foods tend to be very high in fat that aren't necessarily healthy. So that's one thing that we can do. I think the other thing is, when we see fat that's very hard, when we see it, whether that's saturated fat, like you're mentioning, that may be fat on a steak or fat in hamburger that's not very lean or things like that, that you actually see that fat, we know we want to try to avoid most of that.
Right.
And I think in the third realm too, this whole idea of trans fats, fats that are used in processing in foods and things like that, that now have to be listed on the label if something's high in trans fat. We know that that is a type of fat that may increase cholesterol and give us more problems too. The big concern, and I know this is something that's being looked at, of course, very closely with the food industry, is then what kind of fat are they adding? If they're taking out other fats, what, you know, in this idea, this question you said, well, what about certain vegetable fats or palm fruit, which has now been sort of, now it's kind of out there, like palm oil is good for you, and it's being marketed heavily. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think when it comes to fat, the best fats to choose, like you're saying, are more fats that tend to be more either liquid oil fats, let's right. say like olive oil or canola oil type fats.
Well, one of the reasons that triggered this question is that I use the dark sesame oil in some of my Chinese cooking, and I was reading the label, and it was saying that it had 14 grams of fat, which I guess it would be correct.
Mm-hmm.
It had 2 grams saturated, 7 grams polyunsaturated, and 5 grams monounsaturated. So I thought, okay, is sesame oil good, bad, or indifferent? And then this morning in the Bloomington Pantograph, it was talking about low linoleic acid soybeans, and that's good because linoleic oil is trans fat. And I thought, oops, I always thought trans fat was anything that's a hydrogenated whatever. So are there other natural trans fats that we should be avoiding? What about peanut oil? What about avocados?
Well, I think when you look at all these different oils, and I don't think I've got a reference for that offhand, but all the different oils are a little bit different in how much polyunsaturated fat they have, or monounsaturated fat, or they all generally have a little bit of saturated or teeny bit of saturated fat anyway. And I think if you're looking primarily at liquid oils.
I'm looking at ingredients and products I buy.
Yeah, or that, basically, and the fat intake is not that high to begin with, it's not going to be a big problem no matter what, pretty much what liquid oil it is. So if it's got sesame, or you're using sesame oil, sesame oil is just a real balanced oil. It's got a little bit of saturated, some polyunsaturated, some mono. So those types of oils like that are fine to use, as long as you don't use too much, that you get too many calories.
That's a pretty strong oil, though, too, so you don't use very much.
Right, that is not one that you use much of.
Right.
So how about peanuts and avocados?
Right, peanuts, avocados. You know, if you looked at nuts, let's say, in general, there are a lot of different breakdown for the breakdown for nuts is very different depending on the type of nuts. We know that in general, nuts like walnuts, almonds, peanuts. Those tend to be, they all have the health claim for nuts because they're not that high in saturated fat. They all have a little bit different mono and polyunsaturated, but again, a quarter cup of nuts, which is about a serving or so, is not would be healthy for somebody to have every day.
Yeah.
Now, you get in pistachios and cashews and some of those that really tend to taste good. Then, well, they tend to have a little bit more saturated fat. But again, if you can handle the calories and you're not getting fried food and other things, that's certainly a fine place to have that.
And are avocados considered good fat or bad fat?
Right. Avocados are mostly monounsaturated fat, so it's
those
a good...
Those are good.
Mm-hmm. So in general, I think if you look at vegetable oils, nuts, seeds, those kinds of things, that's just where we want most of our fat to come from.
Right.
There's no question because...
Well, I'm getting really picky when I read, you know, my lean or healthy choice or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The zero trans fat and it says hydrogenated fat. Well, I know that they're less than whatever the labeling requirement is. But I just sort of say, all right, if you're going to fool around with me like that, I'm not going to buy you anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I think another thing to look at with that is just the total fat. If the total fat's 3 or 4 or 5 grams for a meal,
mm-hmm.
then to me, the saturated fat or the hydrogenated is really negligible. It's so low
mm-hmm.
that it's not going to be a problem.
It's getting to be the principle of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, right.
Or like the spray, quote, butters are zero fat. That's for 5 sprays, which barely dampens the tip of your tongue.
Mm-hmm. Right. So. You have to look at serving size. That's very, very true, even in something like that.
Okay. Well, I'll just keep reading my labels.
There you go.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk with a listener now in St. Joe on line 3. Hello.
Hi. I have a little bit of a different question related to the immune system. And I have MS. So the belief is that's your immune kind of going crazy against your body, and really what you want to do is a lot of the treatments decrease the function of the immune system. And I was on vacation a couple weeks ago, and I read about a book where somebody had a diet where they were really downplaying boosting the immune system. And I just wondered if you'd heard anything about it or anything.
So in the book, they were saying that looking at immune system wasn't that important?
No, they were actually what they were saying is you want to avoid boosting the immune system.
Hmm.
If your immune system is already in hyper mode.
Right.
The belief with a lot of the autoimmune disorders is that it's your own immune system fighting your body. That is the problem with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just, I'd actually been told to avoid some, supplements that are supposed to really boost your immune system. As far as diet, I just try to follow a healthy, low-fat diet. I mean, I don't do anything real strict, just try to be healthy overall. But I just was wondering if you'd heard about that book or, what you felt about that.
Yeah, I haven't seen that particular book. I know that there's a lot we still don't know about MS and how diet affects it, and there are a lot of different programs out there that I'm sure you've looked at a lot of things, and some of them are very different than other ones in terms of what's recommended. One thing we look at with MS is ways to naturally try to decrease inflammation in the body and to make sure that you're, like you're saying, you're nutritionally sound, you're eating on a schedule, you're balancing what you're eating so that your body has a constant flow of nutrients throughout the day that may help with energy and some other things as well. And so we know that's important, and we know that trying to get the right type of fat, kind of like we just talked about, more monounsaturated fat, less saturated fat, less trans fat, may help, because we know that may help just with injury in the body and again, inflammation, maybe more omega-3 fatty acids, which has certainly been looked at with a lot of people with MS. I don't know that boosting, like you're saying, large amounts of antioxidants that some people recommend, if that really is helping or if that could cause the body to, like you're saying, overreact maybe to that. And so I think when you get into some of these large amounts of supplements that some people do recommend for MS, I would be a little concerned about that just because, again, how's the body going to respond to that? I'm not sure we do know. And I'll have to check out this new book because I haven't seen it yet. But I think what we do know is eating sound, eating on a schedule, staying hydrated, getting enough variety in your diet, and certainly trying to get a lot of natural antioxidants from the foods themselves, a lot of fruits and vegetables. Those things are important. We know that. I don't think that's disputed. But I do think you need to be careful when you're taking, you know, if you're taking large amounts of other things, how that might react in the body. We see that in studies where people have taken large amounts, let's say, of even vitamin C or vitamin A, and in some over time in some people, it kind of works as a pro-oxidant and maybe causing damage in the body. And so we have to keep that in mind from some of the studies we do have. But I haven't seen this specific one. I wish I could answer that. But it kind of makes sense not to go overboard on anything, I would say.
Yeah. No, actually, they were recommending that you don't take, you know, a lot of supplements to boost your immune system. Mm-hmm. They're talking about doing more to avoid things that are going to boost
right.
your immune system.
Yeah. And again, in supplemental form, that may make a lot of sense, you know, to watch that. I don't know that it should affect how you eat, because I think you still want to naturally eat really well.
Well, and that's the first I'd ever heard about altering diet to try to avoid foods that were actually, you know, that were felt to boost your immune system. But, well, I just was curious if you knew anything about that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. Am I on?
Yeah, you are. Go ahead.
I have just a quick question. I've read that your body can't absorb more than 500 milligrams of calcium. I take calcium citrate, and that you have to space it out over the day. Is that true?
Well, your body can certainly absorb more, but we do know that the more you take at one time, the lower the percentage of absorption. And so, for example, if you took 1,000 milligrams at a time, you're going to absorb more than if you took 500, but you're probably not going to absorb as much as if you spaced it out two times during the day. So so it's best to take it twice or three times a day if you're going to take it. It's best to take it where you don't take it with a multivitamin that has other big minerals in it. For example, iron and calcium kind of compete for absorption. So it's best not to take it if you take a multivitamin with iron, not to take calcium with that, but take it separate from that.
Well, I have a multivitamin without iron.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have much calcium in it, which is why I supplement it.
Right. So you're probably in good shape. Usually it's iron that we concern more about if someone has iron in their multi. But, yeah, the best way to take it, we know, is to try to divide it out into two. Let's say if you take 1,000 milligrams, divide it out twice a day, because the percentage of what your body's going to absorb from those is going to be a bit higher. Yeah.
But exactly. if you took it all at once, it wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't hurt your body in any way.
Not as far as I know. I think what happens is just the percentage that's absorbed goes down a little bit.
And the other just passes through.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, we're just about out of time. I thought maybe we'd go back to eye health and talk a little bit about ultraviolet light. Summertime, we're going to be spending more time outdoors. Sunglasses is a good idea.
Right. I think that's the other thing that's coming out of a lot of these studies is looking at people who for years maybe haven't worn good sunglasses. And so that's probably something we all need to take very seriously is wearing sunglasses whenever we're outside. We see, you know, my four-year-old, we see more and more kids when they're out on the playground and her friends who have sunglasses on all the time. And I think that's where we need to start, particularly if you're fair. It seems to be if you're fair and if you have light-colored eyes, you tend to be at higher risk for developing these problems later on. And so definitely, we're saying definitely wear sunglasses that are good quality sunglasses, and also make sure you see your eye doctor periodically, if that's yearly or every other year or how often you do, that it's just so important. I think in many cases, it seems like a lot of people have gone years and years without going to see their optometrist or ophthalmologist, and that causes, you know, maybe they had some beginnings where it could have been somewhat treated. And so I think that's the other thing, is really having regular eye checkups is the other important thing too.
Yeah. I can see her. I can picture your 4-year-old with her sunglasses on and maybe a cute little brimmed hat.
Yeah.
I bet she's adorable. Of course, you would say she is.
Well, of course, yes. But not that she always wants to wear them, I will say. But we try to get her to wear them all the time.
Well, you got to convince her they're cool.
That's right.
Okay, very good. Susan, we'll see you next month in June.
Very good.
Susan Kundrat, she's a registered dietitian. She is the owner of Nutrition on the Move. You will find her at the web at www.eatandmove.com, EATNMOVE.com.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1:51 Central Time, 62 degrees in Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Going to hand things off now to Todd Gleason. He has a look at what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, after making some, well, I don't know whether I'd call them substantial, but after making some gains earlier in the day, corn futures settled back for losses. They were off anywhere between a quarter and a full penny today. The December contract, by the way, I know you're keeping track of that if you're a farmer and you're looking at that harvest month, had a high today of 274 and three quarters. The contract high at $2.75.